You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Diageo Bar Academy. Learn more at diageobaracademy.com. That's Diageo Baracademy.com.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Greg, what's happening in the world today?
Well, I feel, Damon, as responsible semi-journalist adjacent degenerates, we can't open the show without discussing what's going on with the Negroni Spagliato, where it came from, and why everybody is suddenly losing their shit over this drink that no one could spell this time a week ago. Like, is this happening for you out in California as well?
It is. You know, it kind of reminds me in, you know, now looking back over, you know, like 10 years of Negroni Week, say maybe 15 years of the Negroni becoming a popular kind of household name. I mean, like, you know, you go to Trader Joe's and there's a bottled Trader Joe's branded bottled Negroni. I've spoken about this several times.
They have it on Delta now. On Delta flights, they have a canned Negroni. It's fine, but the fact that you can get it in an airplane is, you know, sign of the times.
Well, you know, the thing that gets me about the Spagliato is that, yeah, it's like just like the Negroni. It's been around forever, you know, for a long time at least. And, you know, so the name Spagliato means mistake, right, in Italian? and it is a mistake because the origin of that drink is that apparently a bartender went to grab a bottle of gin, accidentally grabbed a bottle of Prosecco.
As one does.
Or it was an Americano cocktail. Because, like, really what it is, it's an Americano cocktail. But if you think, you know, if you think about it, it's Americano without seltzer. Instead of seltzer, it's Prosecco. So It's a Negroni Spagliato, but really what it is an Americano Spagliato, if you want to get technical about it. But really, I mean, it's just funny. There's tons of memes out there about it, you know, like about, like, all of a sudden, you know, like, liquor stores are out of both Campari and Prosecco. I think it's Big Negroni, you know, pulling one over on us just to, you know, I think they're
okay. So I do actually know where this came from, and not because I'm cool, because I asked someone younger than me who knows. And unfortunately, I don't know if you're aware of this, Damon, but I hate to break it to you if you're not. This is a dragon thing.
Yeah.
It's one of the stars of House of the Dragon, which I have not yet broken down and watched. The day is coming, but I've not reached that point of weakness yet. Thank God. But they were doing some bit where two of the stars were talking about their favorite cocktails. And one of them said that they really like a Negroni Spagliato with Prosecco. But they did say it. I've watched the video. They did say it in, like, a very fun, very sexy way that really just kind of, like, you know, they made that awkward looking word Spagliato really roll off their tongue. And I'm like, okay, I can, you know, they it made me a little thirsty watching it. Like, I could go and have some of this. But, man, the internet did what the internet does, and now all of a sudden it's, like, fucking everywhere. And I'm for it, you know? Yeah. I love the Negroni Spagliato. I think it's a great drink. And, you know, do this responsibly, because you'll see why in a second, but, like, one of my preferred, like, go-to summer drinks is a Negroni Spagliato with just, like, a little float of absinthe on top, because it louches, like, just a little bit. So in addition to getting those really nice kind of, like, green, like hayseed and kind of like anise notes from the absinthe, you also get this really nice kind of pink cloudy layer on top that just looks really fucking cool. So for it. I'm happy it's around.
I'm glad it's not like although I did read on Punch recently that the Mind Eraser is coming back, but, you know, I'd rather it be like, I'd rather it be, you know, the Spagliato having its moment than, you know, the Mind Eraser.
But yeah, I mean, everything, you know, like we've said on the show before, like, everything that's old is new again. There's no such thing as a new idea. But it is, yeah, it's nice when, you know, something that you've always enjoyed, like, it has sort of a moment of obscurity. That's why every year I get really excited when people predict that this is going to be the summer of sherry. And every year for the last 10 years, I've been disappointed.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's fun. It's a great drink. And I think John DeBerry summed it up best with a tweet where he said, as a bartender, I hate it when people come up to me and order drinks. And I'm like, yeah, I've seen a lot of hot takes of people complaining about how many Negroni Spagliatos they have to make. And I'm like, just, you know, it could be mind erasers, guys. Just keep that in perspective.
Well, also, if you're a bartender and you can't build a drink over ice.
Seriously. Like, count your blessings. The Ramos could be having a moment in the sun right now. Oh, like, God. How horrible would that be? This drink takes like 20 seconds to make. Like, you know, take the W, everybody.
I mean, seriously, I will say this. I usually keep my Campari and my vermouth batch together just as a life hack. I'll have a bottle. It's a Torino Milano or Milano Torino, depending on where you are. That's what it is at the base, which is a delicious drink. It's basically the very first Italian mixed drink. And then, you know, from there, they added seltzer water. That's an Americano. Then Count Negroni said, screw seltzer water. Let's put gin in there instead. That became a Negroni. So the Negroni is actually a third variation on that original drink. It's a great drink on its own. But the thing is, it's endlessly riffable, right? So, like, you can make a Negroni with any base spirit. So you can make a Boulevardier or Mezcal Negroni, you know, things like that. So, you know, I would say that, you know, and one of my favorite bars around here, they actually always have those two ingredients batched. So they get a lot of calls for their Negronis. So someone will say, hey, can I have, you know, rye whiskey, make it a Boulevardier, or can I have Mezcal or a rum Negroni, which is delicious. And it's, if you care anything about speed in a bar, like if you're against batching, I mean, that's at least the one thing that you should batch, you know?
Yes.
And then you just pour that and top it with Prosecco and then like take someone's money, you know, that's it. Like,
bam. Yeah. Easy. Yeah. Even throw a little absinthe on top if you're a louche bag like me, you know?
Anyway. So I'm really excited about this show today because it's something that I've, for so long, have like, you know, just labored over and kind of like, I've always tried to find like special pieces of glassware for, you know, I've done like most of my own photo shoot styling and, you know, and I'm always looking for unique glassware. And what's cool about that is, or for my almost 20 years being in this industry, is that the industry started catching up and realizing that there's a huge market for special glassware. So I'm really glad that we're going to be discussing that today, which is fun because we actually have Zane Harris in the studio today, and he's coming to us from the Roswell of New York. So this is going to be really fun. So Zane, welcome to the show. You're in, where did we say we are? You're in Pine Bush, New York, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Hi everybody. Thanks for having me. Just recently moved out to, the country of, you know, Catskills meets Hudson Valley area. I just couldn't, being in the city for almost 13 years in New York, it was time, I think, for me to slow down a bit. Also, I'm getting older, like most of us are. So, definitely coming from the country right now. I'm watching the leaves fall. Awesome. It's beautiful right now.
Well, cool, man. There's a lot to talk about today. We'll talk about UFOs and the alien culture if we get some time, but I think we should jump into it. So your handle is the beverage consultant and product designer for Riedel. That's fucking awesome. So you get to you're the glassware guy.
Yeah, I mean, someone had to do it. I got sick of waiting.
Yeah,
you know, like you said, years of running bars and owning bars and having to take trips out to estate sales and antique stores to try to find non-dishwashable, safe, very delicate glassware just to fit the cocktails that we find to be really popular now, like Negronis, for example. Because, you know, a lot of the glassware nowadays is something that got designed probably in China, and they're much too big and clunky. And so we had to resort to these antique pieces, you know, to match the cocktails that have become so popular. And it just doesn't really exist any sort of meaningful or affordable or practical sense until this glassware.
Yeah. I mean, like for the longest time, it was the Libby 3773 the 5.5 ounce coupe glass. You know, that was like the only coupe glass you could get forever, unless you went to like you said, like go upstate New York, and like that's where I used to go to buy all my cool antique glassware. Like I mean, there's endless antique stores up there, but you know, like it's not sustainable, obviously, because you know, I would buy like old like Waterford crystal coupes, and you know, whenever I'd find them, and I would pay a fortune for them, and you know, use them for like VIPs and photo shoots mostly, but you know, even just having them around, they're gonna get broken, you know. So like it's always just so heartbreaking. But it's cool that like things are like we're in a far better place now with glassware design. So how did you actually get connected with them to get in this role?
So that's a really interesting story and kind of been romanticized over the years now. Alongside doing the glassware design and the beverage consulting, I'm also a beverage consultant for Southern Glazers. Oh, cool. So I help them with their craft department. Pretty much we're in-house beverage consultants.
So you work with Alan Katz?
And we're constantly... Yeah, Alan Katz is on cool. the same team as I am. We've worked together for years. Love Alan. Mm-hmm. Great guy. If you guys haven't checked out, people who are listening, New York Distilling Co., I highly recommend you check out all their products, from their gins to their rye whiskeys and all the stuff they have coming in the future. Love that guy. Can't support him enough. And it's amazing juice. So anyway, what we do is we pretty much help restaurants and bars and hotels build out programs, full programs. Even construction of the bars themselves, we oversee and help with this, help them save money. Then, of course, help them with the profitability side. And then mixology is pretty much the last thing. But throughout that, you know, you're constantly picking out your spirits. You're picking out your bar tools. Everything you have pretty much control over. You know who makes it, right? We know who makes our booze. I have no idea who makes glassware. I you know, so you have to piece it together. Like, who the heck make, and I hope it's not some human rights violation in somewhere in China. You know what I mean? Some kids making our glassware so we can drink our Spagliatos. So I just constantly felt this one gap in what I do on a day-to-day basis was I have no control over the glassware, really. So for years I heard, you know, our comrades complain about glassware, wishing for certain things. I had been taking notes for almost 2 decades on everything that I would do. If I ever got a chance to be in the room with a glassware maker, who the heck knows what a glassware maker is or who they are, right? They're always usually some faceless company that makes our glassware, like Libby, right? I have no idea who's behind Libby. By rote, Southern also distributes Riedel, mostly wine glasses. And so I was placing a lot of Riedel by default. George and Max Riedel, the 10th and 11th generation glassware makers from that company, caught notice that there's this unknown person in New York placing large amounts of their glassware and their decanters and everything. And they'd never heard of me before. So they invited me to go to this 3-day-long seminar with them, which was, you know, I felt was a pretty big honor, but here was my chance, right? I was about to be in the room with glassware makers. And maybe if I pulled them aside and I pitched them this idea, maybe I could change the industry and make my job a little bit easier, was the idea. So in like the second day, I was really listening to what George, the 10th generation, the older gentleman, had to say about wine glasses and why they chose the shapes. I don't know if you know about Riedel glassware, but they have wine-specific glassware, which means that they have shapes that make a Pinot Noir taste better than out of another shape. And I always thought it was bullshit, right? I always thought it was some marketing ploy. But they did whole tastings side by side with different glassware shapes with the exact same wine out of the exact same bottle, and it made a drastic difference, not only in the nose, but also in where it delivered it to the tongue, right? The tip of the tongue versus the middle of the tongue. I remember him saying, for higher alcohol content wines, like Amarones, for example, they wanted to make sure that higher proof wine didn't hit the tip of your tongue, because the tip of your tongue is like the tip of your finger. It's very sensitive to tactile things, but it's also very sensitive to alcohol content. So if it hits the tip of your tongue, it tastes more alcoholic than it actually is. But if it hits your mid palate on the back, it's much more smoother of an experience, which I thought was interesting because I'd never thought about that when it came to cocktails before. So I was taking all these notes and I had pulled up a little 3D program, a little CAD program on my laptop, and I started designing glassware based off of what he was saying in front of me. And this is where it starts to get kind of lore-y, and people have different versions as a story, but this is exactly what happened. I remember he had said something about carbonation, and you know, I can speak freely in this room. I'm a nerd when it comes to things like that. And he had said that a shape of a glass affects how big the bubbles are. And I, you know, I raised my hand and I said, no, actually what really affects it is the surface of the inside of the glass. You're looking for nucleation sites where the CO2 can gather together and be released. And if you have very small abrasions on the inside of the glass, which happens normally, then you get smaller bubbles. If you have bigger abrasions, you get bigger bubbles. That's the way it goes. And he kind of looked at me sideways. Everybody else in that room worked for Riedel. There's about 80 people in the room. And just like any of these companies, I think that they very much look up to the Riedels because they're a family-owned business, and they're not used to somebody raising their hands and correcting George Riedel on something. And he took it really well, right? And we had a little bit of a back and forth. I wouldn't call it an argument, but it was a bit of a back and forth. And I said, hey, listen, you know, it's science. You should try it. I'm sure you have a little sandblaster. Etch the inside of your glass and see what happens. And he really liked the idea that I was talking science, not talking like opinion, I guess. Then it went on and I kept on listening to what he was saying. I kept on designing and he didn't think I was paying attention. So he walked over to the table and he slammed his hand really hard down on the table. And he said, if you're not going to pay attention, get out of my room. Right. So I was like in this very thick Austrian German accent. And I just turned my laptop to him and there was what now became the rocks glass rotating on screen, a 3D version of it. And I said, hey, we should talk at lunch is what I said to him. That's all I said to him. And he looked at me and he took about 3 seconds and he goes, I'll see you at lunch. Now, everybody else in that room was like they're like, everybody else in the room was like, holy shit, they're going to get a fist fight out in the parking lot at lunch. And so we disappeared at lunch. I pitched him the idea of, you know, why this is necessary, right? The bar world changed, but the glassware didn't. And we're constantly having to fill these gaps with doing what we already talked about, right? Searching for vintage glassware that isn't being produced anymore, that is definitely not dishwasher safe, and is usually way too expensive. And I said, if he wants to make a big difference in the bar world, and if he also wants to make a shit ton of money, be the first glassware company that actually listens to the bar industry on what it is that they need, because nobody else is doing it, right? I got halfway through my pitch and he put his hand on my shoulder. And in my head, I was thinking, okay, well, at least I tried, right? I can go back to all of my friends in the industry and say, hey, I got in front of a glassware maker. They weren't interested though. So, you know, I did my best. But instead he said, I love it. Put it into a professional presentation. Do you think we can get a functional prototype within a year? And I was just so taken aback. I was like, I can get you the entire line in a year with 3D printing and whatnot. Why not? Let's do it. It actually took a year and a half because I decided that we would take the prototypes all around the world to all the different bars that I really respect, give them the prototypes for a night, see what they thought about it, then take all of their notes and funnel it through myself. And what came out the other end is this glassware line called DSG or drink specific glassware from Riedel. So I like to say, you know, it has my name on the box, but it's really our industry's glassware because so many people had feedback from all different walks of life in our bar world. And even home bartenders, which, you know, I think I personally really appreciate. It's not just coming through my brain, but through a lot of other people who are a lot smarter than I am.
Damn, dude. So I mean, yeah. Wow. I'm glad that these things exist. I had no idea that the path to them existing was so incredibly riveting. I was sitting over here. I was like, man, I wish I had some popcorn to eat while I was just like listening to this story. So now, I mean, I want to know, I want to hear about these notes. I want to hear about, you know, what makes these things different? What did you look at, you know, when you look at, you know, your usual 5.5 ounce coupe or your usual double rocks glass, and you're like, I find this wanting. And what did you do to fix it?
That is a kind of a big question, because one of the things I wanted to make sure that we did was not be the MySpace to someone else's Facebook. So I didn't want to open up the door to having our industry have say in the glassware and not think every detail through to the max. Like my goal, honestly, and this is maybe the capitalist in me, was to make sure that this was such a good design and so thoughtful that anybody else or any other company that wanted to do this without me being involved would think it would be an insurmountable task. Like they couldn't improve on it. So the first thing that we had to look at was the actual volume of the glassware. Because, you know, a martini is 3 ounces, right? Plus maybe 3/4 of an ounce to an ounce of dilution from the ice. That you know, you're looking at, like you said, 5.5 ounces, but that's not enough clearance. So it goes right to the wash line goes right to the edge. We all know this with those Libby coupes. And it sucks to drink out of. You feel like an idiot, you know, just like you feel like an idiot drinking out of a champagne flute. It's not conducive to the end user whatsoever. And it's definitely not conducive to our servers having to put these things on trays and try to take them out and look professional, right? Hell, even pushing them across the bar made us look like sloppy bartenders because they splashed everywhere. So instead I went with a just a little over a 6 ounce for our Nick and Nora, which we can get talking about Nick and Nora's pretty in depth in a little bit, but I want to answer your question first. Just take a note, because the Nick and Nora is a very tender spot in my heart. Anyway, so the volume was important. And when I came back to him with the volumes of all the different glasses, which there are 7 of them now, they said, oh, these are very odd. You know, these volumes don't really exist. And I was like, yeah, I know. That's kind of the point. And that's kind of the problem that we're fixing here. And they're like, oh, they were just, okay, I get it now. Because it was all based off of not only the cocktails are going to be going in them, right? Each glass is designed for a specific category of drink, right? You have your Manhattan martinis for the Nick and Nora. You've got your sours, traditional and non-traditional, and the sour glass, right? Those are 2 different volumes that you need, because you got to think about juice and egg white or aquafaba or whatever it is you're going to be using in it. Then you got your highball glass, which, you know, you're talking about highballs. You're also talking about things underneath there like Tom Collins's and anything served as a 1-in-1 as well. Then the fizz glass, right, which doesn't really exist in the market. We always have to use some weird juice glass that usually diners use for orange juice in our bars to get the right size, which is stupid. then, of course, we've got the rocks glass. Always a double rocks, never a single rocks. So old fashions look tiny in them. And then a neat glass, which was very, very important to me, because I hate serving neat spirits out of a rocks glass because my guests feel like they're getting ripped off. It just looks like you didn't pour anything in the glass if you're hitting 2 ounces, right? So the neat glass is really important for Sazeracs too. And, you know, a lot of people, they don't like drinking their martinis or Manhattans or Boulevardiers out of a stemmed glass. I don't know why. Sometimes they feel like their sexuality is wrapped up in the glassware that they drink out of for some reason. I don't get it. Or sometimes they just feel like they're clumsy. Either way, I wanted to make sure that that neat glass was there for people who wanted their up drinks served down, as it were. But yeah, so this offered us the opportunity to get the volumes right. So everything has that 2-centimeter wash line from the top. 2 centimeters, I found, is enough leeway to make it so you can cheers someone without splashing each other's knuckles. You can take it out to a table, no problem, on a tray, or you can slide it across the bar. Also, nose clearance is important. So then my next thing was displacement of ice, right? So I had to make sure that any sort of ice that was going in these glasses was displacing these liquids, these cocktails properly, without sticking out of the glass. I had to make sure that, you know, my glass was tall enough that that cold draft or Hoshizaki ice cubes for you ice nerds out there didn't hit your nose when you're drinking out of it. Especially in the highball glass, we're seeing a decline in straws being used in bar programs. So I want to make sure this glassware is designed to be able to be comfortably drank without a straw. Then, of course, the next thing I had to worry about was the ice itself. does it fit? I'm sure you've all, you know, dealt with this with a rocks glass, but you take a really nice hand cut 2x2 ice cube and you try to put it into a regular rocks glass. And there's about 3/4 of an inch of a gap underneath the ice cube in the glass, because the inside of the glass is actually cantilevered in, you know, it's not straight sided. The reason why glassware companies do that is it's a lot cheaper and easier to make glassware that way, because the molds are easily pulled out of the center of the glass. And so what you see is this conical shape on the inside. Even if the outside is straight, the inside will be conical because it's just easier for them to during production. But that makes it so we have to knock the edges off of our nice, beautiful cubes to get it to fit in there. So we're handling ice with our hands or tongs, heaven forbid, you know, smashing ice all over the guests or at your home bar. And I thought that was stupid. It was slowing down my bartenders. It was slowing down me. So the inside of the glass had to accommodate larger ice cubes. It also has to accommodate regular ice, like the cold draft ice in Hoshizaki. A lot of times with that conical shape, you get an inverted pyramid of ice, which is that one ice cube on the bottom and the two or three on the top. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. And you have to hit it. I know. We all hate it. So I designed the glass to hold ice cubes naturally side by side in the bottom of the rocks glasses.
God bless you, sir.
So you don't have to poke it with I know. You know, that's important for a couple of different reasons because, you know, you want the displacement to happen. You want the level of the finished cocktail to be at the right level, right? If the ice cube hasn't fully fallen into the cocktail, it's not displacing it and not raising that level up enough. And the drink looks either sloppy, unfinished, or that you're ripping off the guest. So that was really important, you know. But then I also had to worry about the dishwashers that this glassware was going to be going into. How many can I fit in a flat rack, right? So I really messed with the diameters a lot to try to fit an extra row in a standard flat rack, so the bartenders didn't have to run as many loads. That translates into dollars and cents for the business owner, right? If I'm going to be a beverage consultant, I have to think about how much it costs to operate your dishwasher and how can I reduce that as much as possible. We also had to think about tempering, right? So dishwashers, especially commercial ones, are super hot. And then when we're busy, we're taking super hot glasses and we're throwing crushed ice in it to cool it down because we're low on glassware because we're busy on a Friday or Saturday. That causes microfractures if you don't temper the glass all the way. Most glasses are only tempered the top third of the glass to try to protect the lip. Well, untempered glass meeting tempered glass, they cool down at different rates. And so it causes microfractures. You guys ever see that L-shaped break you get in glasses? Yeah. So that line that shoots across horizontally, that's where the temper line of that glass is. And that glass isn't breaking from being hit on the lip of the glass. It's being broken because over time, the hot, cold creates microfractures at that border where non-tempered meets tempered. And so you get this crack that shoots straight up and one that shoots right across where the temper.
See, I told you it wasn't my fault. Every bar manager I've ever worked for, it wasn't me. Yeah. It was stupid glassware.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so what we did was a triple temper on this glasses. We made sure that the entire glass was tempered three times in decreasing temperatures, so there's no leftover energy in it. If you ever want to see what I'm talking about leftover energy, look up St. Rupert's Drops on YouTube. It's a really crazy phenomenon that happens with molten glass, or in this case, crystal, if you don't temper it correctly. It's insane. I'm going to leave that be a little nugget. St. Rupert's Drop. But that's what I was trying to eliminate in this glassware with that tempering. And while we're on the subject of breakage, which is to most glassware companies is a bad word, but for us, you know, it's something of a challenge. When you're dealing with a company like Riedel that's been around for like almost 270 years, and they're on their 11th generation, they don't really care about short-term sales. They care about long-term partnerships with restaurant groups and hotel groups and stuff. So to them, they try to make the highest quality glass. And if they can reduce breakage as much as possible, that's a very good thing for them, because then that means that that company will use their glassware for a long period of time. So I took that and I ran with it. Most of the breakage in my bars, and I'm sure in yours as well, was when you take hot or cold glasses and nest them or stack them inside of another glass.
Oh, yeah.
And they stick together.
That's bad, bad move.
Unless you
hate it when I see that. Ugh. It's the worst.
Not horrible. And then you try to, like, you're looking at your guest as you're tapping it on its side. And of course, inevitably, one or two of them breaks, right? I did a bit of a survey in one of my bars, and I found out that over 60%, it was 61.8% of my breakage over the course of 3 months was due to nested glassware, not to clumsy bartenders or drunk, barbacks, or, asshole guests pushing it off the table. It was the vast majority of it was nested glassware. So if I wanted my glass to not be heavy as shit and not be nested inside of each other, but I wanted them still to be stackable, it gave me the opportunity. You guys have seen this glassware, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got like that starburst pattern on the bottom.
It's very classy.
That's there for function as well as form. It makes it so when you stack the glasses butt to butt, they lock into each other. And so you have the stackability without it sliding around on itself, but not in the traditional sense of nesting it inside where all the breakage happens. And that happened in, it's universal across the line. So you can stack like with like, or you can stack them differently, like have rocks glasses on the bottom and neat glasses on top, and they still lock.
This is what happens when someone who's actually been behind the bar for a while, who's experienced all this, gets the opportunity to actually be on the design team. So, like, this is why I always say, like, when it comes to distributors and sales, like, hire bartenders. They know how to sell people booze, when it comes to that. But also, I mean, this also kind of reminds me of like the 86 company when they were designing their bottle. It's like there was a group of bartenders who got together and they had like a little powwow, and like they kind of voiced all their woes with like bottles and the shapes and the different like elements that would be helpful, with like the label that peels off and graduated measurement on the side for inventory and like different grips and all this stuff. It's like, yeah, well, it's the best bottle design because, the people who use the bottles all the time got a say in it, right? And this is what it's the exact same thing with glassware. Yeah. So to me, this is just fascinating. I'm like full on, like on my bed with my chin in my hands and my legs kicking up, like total like 80s movie style, like got the long cord on my phone and I'm just like,
just twirling your finger, like, tell me more.
Yeah, exactly.
it's a nice visual.
It's like almost like we're talking dirty, but yeah, this is.
Yeah. I mean, when you hear stuff like this, you kind of think, why don't companies, I don't know, why don't they listen to us more? That's all. I think it's ridiculous. How like I had to, pull someone aside and be like, hey, I work with your products. Do you think maybe you want to ask me some questions? How to make it better, how to make more money, right? How do you make more money? Make
and,
a better
you know,
product,
brand loyalty, as you said before, those long-term relationships rather than short-term sales. We're at a point now where we should take a break. We'll take a quick break and we'll get back. I want to ask you kind of almost like a speed round of this glass versus that glass and see your thoughts on that. But we'll take a quick break and when we get back, we'll continue talking about glassware with our buddy Zane Ayers. Back in a few. Greg, it's that time of year again.
It is. I can't believe it's here again.
I know. It's the year's really just flown by, but it is time for the 2023 season of the U.S. Bartenders Guild and Diageo's world-class cocktail competition. This is the biggest cocktail competition in the world. And the cool thing is this year, actually it'll be next year, but the finals will be happening in Sao Paulo, Brazil. In Brazil! Like, I want to get involved in this just so I can go to Brazil. But yeah, I mean, like, this is, it's the biggest cocktail competition in the world. Lots of crazy events and different rounds. It's insane. You can go to DiageoBarAcademy.com and see about last year's world class. They actually wrapped it in Sydney, Australia, another place I would love to go to. And yeah, I mean, have you been to any of these competitions before, Greg?
Yeah, actually, I was super fortunate. I got to go to the U.S. finals this past June in Nashville.
Nice.
And you can tell it was a good time because I used the word fortunate to describe Nashville in June. But it was a ton of fun. You know, I got to see a lot of really amazing cocktails, some of which were based on Nashville hot chicken, some of which were based on banana pudding. It was a blast. And just hang out with people who were just at the top of their game, but also just having a shitload of fun and hanging out with everybody else. Like, right. that was super cool to watch and be around. And, you know, just sample for research, for work.
Yeah, for sure. Just, it's work.
Yeah.
Well, there's so much fun and kind of like just, you know, like the different competitions of different satellite cities. But like, there's also a lot of these recipes. They're documented on DiageoBarAcademy.com. If you go to DiageoBarAcademy.com, you can actually find a lot of other stuff besides world class. There's like master classes and e-learning. There's even stuff you can learn how, like doing your liquor costs and your cocktail costing is like a huge thing. There's a calculator on there for that. Just tons of cool stuff. So if you go check it out, it's DiageoBarAcademy.com. That's DiageoBarAcademy.com. Go check it out. And we are back. You're listening to the Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. And in the studio today, we have Zane Harris from Riedel. And, you know, okay, this has been, I don't know, Greg, I'm having a great time on this show because...
Oh, dude, yeah, this is a ton of fun.
It's the thing that I have nerded out probably, like, I probably, you know, like back in the 19th century when we started using, like, citrus juice in cocktails, and that was really fancy, and the juice actually cost more than the booze in the cocktail.
Those were the days, man.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
This is like, I'm more excited about the glassware than the actual cocktail in that kind of the same regard, you know? But yeah, so we've been talking about how Zane got into this, which is really fascinating. But then we're talking about all the innovative moves that you've made with this glassware, which is awesome, wildly fascinating. I want to talk to you about, there's a big question, you know, like I know right now there's this slight resurgence in like the classic V-shaped martini glass. It's also the bane of people's existence because, as you mentioned before, for servers and bartenders to move the drink around, it usually, you know, it'll slop out the side, you know. And I work in brandy a lot and like treat spirits, and like I want to get your take on the brandy snifter versus like a Glencairn or a neat glass. Like, what's your take on some of these? I want to kind of go through a round of different glasswares. What's your take on, say, a snifter?
Snifters and Glencairn glasses are
bullshit. Thank you.
Okay. They literally do the opposite of what you want a glass to do when you're dealing with a straight spirit like brandy. You know this. Everybody knows this. Like, open up a bottle of booze and stick your nose right in the top of it and see if you can smell what it is. No. All you can smell is ethanol. All you can smell is the alcohol fumes coming off of it, right? That's because this larger vessel, think of it like a brandy snifter or, you know, the Glencairn glass, it's bigger on the bottom than it is at the top. So all of those fumes get funneled up, right? They don't get dispersed outwards. They go straight up into your nostrils, and it burns your nostrils. You're not smelling the booze. You're smelling the alcohol.
It's like compression and reflux, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so what you want is something that actually flares out. There's a couple of glasses there. Like Riedel worked with cognac and scotch producers. And they asked them, same thing they did with me, right? What is the best shaped glass? Like, let's come up with the best shape that actually works. And what they came up with is this almost this tulip shape. So it's straight sided and it flares out. That by far is the best glass that I've found, other than something like a neat glass, right? That is straight sided, that doesn't funnel everything inwards to do any sort of straight spirit or high proof alcohol. That's what I suggest for sure. You actually smell the product, not just the alcohol.
Thank you for backing up what I've been saying for a very long time. All right.
Yeah. I hate the Glencairn
glass. I do too. I do.
But that was like, oh, but it doesn't break when you drop it.
Well, don't drop it.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't drop it.
There's a quick fix to that problem.
I forgot to tell you. It seems like a stupid reason to pick a glass anyway.
But okay, so next one. Martini glass versus coupe versus Nick and Nora.
Martini glasses are coming back in fashion, I guess. But to me, it's all about the angle, right? So I've designed a martini glass that I like, that I hope to be able to produce soon, that has a much steeper angle as opposed to being flatter, right? A lot of the martini glasses on the market right now are, it's almost like drinking out of your cupped hands. It's it's just wildly impractical. Looks cool. I mean, it is the martini glass, the V martini glass is a vibe. For sure. But it also does the opposite of what a glass like that should do. So Nick and Nora versus coupe. Now, the only reason a champagne coupe is in our bars as a cocktail glass is because of the utter lack of the Nick and Nora being in production until now. So it's been like a compromise. Like, what's the shape that kind of curves inward that I can have out there? Oh, a champagne coupe. But if you look at a Nick and Nora, a real Nick and Nora versus a champagne coupe, which we're using in bars mostly now, it's a lot shallower and a lot wider than it should be. So what happens for, you know, fizzy drinks or any other drinks is they warm up or they go flat a lot faster than they should because there's a lot more surface area. So coupe for me is like a good substitute for a Nick and Nora. A Nick and Nora, if you don't know, is named after the two main characters from, first it was a play and then it became a popular movie, back in the 30s called The Thin Man. And in it, the two main characters are a married couple named Nick and Nora. She's like an heiress and he's like a retired murder detective who, is like a kept man, pretty progressive from the 1930s. So she's the breadwinner and he's the kept man. And every once in a while he'll consult with the police department on murders. Really interesting and hilarious. It's a comedy. There's like two or three
there's
movies.
There's seven of them actually.
Jesus, yeah. There's seven. Okay.
It was the Fast and Furious of its day.
I was going to say it was the...
Yeah, exactly.
The Game of Thrones.
The Rock makes it.
House of Dragons. But anyway.
In it, they drink heavily, and often, right? All the time. And there's a couple of famous scenes, in them. There's this one where Nora, she's been at the bar waiting for Nick for a long time. And she has five empty, what look like coupe glasses, but what they really are is Nick and Nora glasses. Now, back in the day, the actors that played Nick and Nora, they were like the Brad and Angelina of their time, highly influential. So everybody wanted these glasses, and that's why it's called a Nick and Nora. Unbeknownst to them, though, it made the perfect cocktail glass for and the shape for anything stirred. So stirred means, you know, usually higher alcohol content, no citrus, no egg white, no cream, right? It's just something that's stirred and then poured into a glass. And the reason why it's the perfect shape is because that inward curve forces you to tilt your head backwards when you're drinking out of it, delivering the higher proof alcohol to your mid palate instead of the tip of your tongue, like I mentioned earlier. So things like martinis and Manhattans and all the many variants of those drinks taste a lot smoother out of a glass like that than, let's say, a martini glass would. Because a martini glass, it flares out, so it hits the tip of your tongue. And so you're like, whoo, this martini is very strong, when maybe it's not. Maybe it's just being delivered to the wrong part of your tongue.
That's amazing.
That answers
your question. That's great. I mean, like, here's another part of it, too. You'd mentioned that the coupes, a lot of them, especially some modern coupes out there, they're really elegant and they're like really wide and flat. But think of it in the same way as you would think about ice, right? So you're like your ice cube and while we're talking about this, I hate the added little, what do you call it? The little carafe on the side with the other half of your martini.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, the hey, we couldn't fit your whole milkshake into here, so here's the icy tin that we made it in. And, you know, enjoy slopping out of that, buddy.
Well, it's like whenever like you get a martini or any drink that's like served with the dividend, I think is what Julie Reiner calls it. Or even glass of wine. Like if I'm drinking a white wine and it comes with a little carafe on, like a demi carafe on the side, I'm like, put the whole fucking thing in there because it's just going to get warmer faster. If you concentrate the temperature around each other, like the all the liquid in one place together, just like you would with like an ice mold, like an ice ball, for instance, you know, which I also have opinions on. But the thing is, it's the perfect shape to keep the ice cold longer and keeps it from melting, which again, that's a whole other episode. But I feel like the Nick and Nora compacts the drink together in more of an, you know, a centralized area.
Yes.
And so it then,
yes, there's less surface area in contact with the glass that emanates or transfers heat from the outside air into the drink, thus warming it up. Yeah.
And, I agree. Okay. So I'd like, thank you again for that. But, but while we're talking about glassware and just on the subject of these dividends and stemware, what's your take on, I mean, I know it's not really a cocktail specific glass, but like a stemless wine glass?
Gross. I don't know. For me, you know, I'm part Italian and I grew up with a very Italian grandfather. Well, wine served with food and dinner. And, you know, if you're doing food right, you're getting stuff on your fingers, in my opinion. And the last thing I want is greasy fingerprints all over my wine glass. But also, temperature is very important when it comes to wine glasses. Same thing with cocktails, right? We're always fighting three things with when making cocktails for other people. It's pretty much dilution, temperature, and service time. Those are the things that we're constantly trying to fight and balance. With wine, it's pretty much the same thing. You know, a red wine is a lot of times better, you know, chilled down a little bit. White wine, we always chill it down, except for in some very niche cases. If you're using, and my hands are hot, I don't know about yours, but I run like, I'm a very warm boy. and so if I have my big mitts wrapped around a wine glass, it's gonna turn into my body temperature. So I don't know about you, but I don't want to drink lukewarm wine all the time. I mean, it's just gross. I want cellar temperature.
Yeah, there's the 20-minute rule is what I've always heard. So if you don't have a wine fridge and you've got your white wine in your standard refrigerator, you're supposed to take it out 20 minutes before you serve it because it'll bring the temperature up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then vice versa with red wine. Put it in the refrigerator for 20 minutes before you serve it because it brings the temperature down to a perfect serving temp, right?
Yeah. It's 64 degrees, right? You want it right around between 62 and 64 degrees, in my opinion, for a red wine and a white wine a little bit chillier than that. But yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, stemless is cool looking. But again, when we're talking about design, you know, actual like worthwhile, lasting, stand the test of time design, you have to bring in form and function. That's why the Germans really know what they're doing. It's always form and function. Yeah. So if it doesn't have the function, I'm not interested.
And one more. So I kind of want to just touch back on the rocks glass versus Cape. So we had a little while back, we had Lacey Hawkins on the show, and she was talking about, she also moved upstate New York, and you know, she's the brand ambassador for Monkey 47 Gin, and we got on the subject of a martini.
Not anymore. Oh, she's not. She works with Diageo now. She's the cultural ambassador for Johnny Walker now.
Well, when she was on the show, she was still with Monkey 47. But what we were talking about was the martini being served up or on the rocks. And she made some really great arguments for serving a martini on the rocks. One, she said that now that she's living upstate, she would make a giant martini in like a mason jar. She said she could put a lid on it, take it with her wherever she goes. Also, the fact that there's nothing worse than a warm martini, right? So it
just like a warm beer.
Exactly.
Sorry.
So, I mean, do you have any opinions on serving these classic cocktails like a Manhattan and a martini on ice?
So one of the things I learned about being an asshole mixologist in my past is it's not about the drink, it's about how someone chooses to enjoy it and if they're having a good time doing it, right? But there's some caveats to that. If you're going to do it one way or the other, there's some suggestions I have. I like both ways for different reasons, right? There's an elegance to having a stirred drink served up. There's also a lifespan on that, I feel, that's shorter than on the rocks. If you have them on the rocks, you can choose how boozy you have it by, you know, drinking it faster or slower, having it even colder than stirred, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. When I'm doing batching for something that's served up and it's already in my freezer and my refrigerator, I add my dilution to it at 20%, right? 20% dilution to a martini in the fridge that stays in my mason jar. I'll serve that up. But if I don't do any dilution and I can serve it over the rocks, then I'm relying on that 20% dilution from the ice to balance out the drink. I don't know if you ever tried, people who are listening, a cocktail that's not diluted, like a Negroni, just straight, no dilution. Good luck enjoying that puppy. For me, it's a mood thing, and it's also who you're hanging out with, what the situation is. Just do those technical things, right? First, to make sure that it's the best experience possible. If you choose out on the rocks, awesome. Just make sure you don't dilute it first, because that ice is going to be melting and adding water. And by the time you get to the bottom of the glass, it's going to taste like martini flavored water. Right. Nobody wants that.
I kind
of
do.
but if you're serving it up, make sure that, you know, it has the dilution in there.
Cool. Okay. Sure. One last drink where ice combo question. What's your opinion on, it was kind of trending, it's been trending still over the past few years, but up with an ice cube.
Hate it. Stupid.
Yeah.
Dumb.
It's so dumb. Dumb.
It's Instagram. There's this whole thing that we call Instagram drinks, right? In my little circle, and probably you do too, where they're really cool looking, but then have you ever tried to drink out of that glass with that stupid ice ball or ice cube sticking out of your coupe or your Nick and Nora or your sour glass?
And also,
it's dumb.
I've seen more glassware. Like, if it's not from, as you'd mentioned before, about heat variation and micro abrasions in the glassware, that's what I've seen mostly breaking cocktail glasses is, you know, trying.
Of course. They're not designed to have ice in it.
Thank you. You know what? This has been the best episode ever because he's agreed with everything I've said.
I do have something to say about the sidecar, the little carafe on the side.
Okay.
If I may. I agree. If someone's just giving you a carafe not on ice on the side, oof. But for the same reason you said that nobody likes a warm martini, it's the same reason why I don't order large beers. Because by the time I get to the bottom third of it, it's going to be warm and gross, and I'm not going to want it, right? So when I'm bartending, I'm in sales, whether I want to admit it or not. Yeah. I'm trying to get someone to buy that next drink. If I'm a good bartender, I'm asking someone if they want another drink in that the last couple of sips that are in the glass, right? And if I'm a really good salesperson, I'm going to make sure that I design my drinks to taste the best at the end, not the beginning. So therefore, when I do ask them if they would like another, they have the best version of the drink freshly on their lips in that moment. And so they're more apt to say yes. So for a martini, the same thing. Some of these glasses can be pretty large. I don't think that when you get to the bottom of a martini, it's always the optimal temperature, right? Especially if you're in a conversation with someone. It sits there on the table for a little bit too long, and now you've got a tepid martini. Gross. I'm definitely not buying another one. If somebody serves me a smaller Nick and Nora that's chilled, half of it goes in the chilled Nick and Nora, and the half goes into like a little carafe that's on crushed ice that keeps it nice and cold without diluting it, and I get to top it off halfway through, I'm a happy camper. Oh, and chill my olives. For God's sake, chill my olives, please. Nothing like getting a lukewarm olive put into a chilled cocktail to really bring that temperature up.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's my take right there. That's my hot take.
Nice. Well, this has been awesome. Greg, I don't know. When I saw that this episode was coming up, I was really psyched about it because it's something that obviously we've just agonized over for a very long time. And it's so cool to have the options of this awesome, very specific glassware for these cocktails. Cocktail specific glassware.
No, I love it. And it's the exact same things that we were talking about, you know, when you make these drinks at home or like at a bar and the cold draft cubes, like they don't fit two to the bottom of your glass. And it's like, it's all things that I think everyone in our industry has just been annoyed with for like fucking years. And yet no one up until now has been like, maybe there's a better way to do this. You know, we all just kind of accept it. It's like, well, it sucks, but that's the way it is. But I'm glad that it's not the way it is anymore. So thank you, Zane.
Yeah, of course. And while we're on the subject of home bartenders, the pandemic really shot home bartender knowledge through the roof. I don't know if you're noticing this in your bars or not, but people are coming back into the wild with a lot more knowledge than they had before.
Like Spagliato's.
exactly like Spagliato's. That's an obscure drink. Whether we want to admit it or not, that's a pretty obscure drink, even for Negroni fans. And so it's nice to be able to offer this to the home mixologist as well, because I want them to be able to use the right glassware, because that gets them excited to come into our bars and, you know, try out new things, to pick up those books that all of our friends write, and actually start working their way through the recipes. And that's an exciting thing to me, because, you know, we put a lot of time, effort, and love into this, and giving them the right vessel to make it at home is important.
Oh, yeah. And having people come in that you don't have to, you know, you're not starting from square one, or that maybe even, you know, oof, brass ring scenario, share some of my same annoyances that I have with things that happen behind the bar, like glassware that doesn't work, or, you know, ice cubes in coupe glasses. Like, oh, it's been nice. So if people wanted to find out more about you and the glassware you're designing and all of your many, many endeavors, where can they get in touch with you and follow what you're up to?
A couple different ways, actually. Real.com has stuff on the actual glassware itself. For me, I'm on social media, Zane Harris on everything. So you can reach out if you guys have any questions. I love talking about this stuff. We just kind of scratched the surface of the functionality. Right. There's a lot more to it. Like, there's built-in measurements in the design on the outside of the glass. I don't know if you knew that or not.
Very cool.
There's a 2-ounce pour line that, you know, that the guest can't see, for example, but the bartender or the bar owner or the manager definitely knows if somebody's hitting that 2-ounce pour line or not. So if you want to learn out more about that kind of stuff, feel free to reach out. Also, I'm in New York all the time. I'm at every event, BCB, Tales of the Cocktail, all over the place. So I'm not hard to find, that's for sure. Cool.
Well, thanks for taking the time to chat with us today. This has been very enlightening and also obviously very entertaining. Again, thanks for agreeing with all my bullshit.
Well, you kind of made it easy, right? You agreed with me, so hey, thank you.
Cool. All right, thanks a lot, Zane. That's it for the Speakeasy this week. Check out Heritage Radio Network for many more programs like this one. Until next week, everyone, cheers.
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 So you don't shun the devil with your rock.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.